Hello and welcome. Today I am joined by Emily Ball, who is a podiatrist and MD of Active Step Healthcare and recently co-founder of Leading Practice, which we'll go into a little bit later on. But I think it's a really exciting model of supporting people who run their own practice and helping them really grow and develop and put things in place, which, yeah, I think it's a great idea and I'm looking forward to hearing more about. So, Emily, thank you for joining. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Yeah, no, whenever we've not known each other long and we've only met a couple of times and chatted, I always get very excited and we run away with different chats of things because I like the way you think. So we'll try and keep this as succinct and interesting for everyone else, not just for what I like.
For us.
No, exactly. So yeah, there's loads of things that we'll go into later on, but just talk to me about where you're from originally and how you got involved in this area.
Well, interestingly, my first career was actually recruitment. So I went to university at 18, dropped out after a year, did psychology actually, which is a fascinating topic, but didn't really know what I wanted to do. So sort of fell into sales. And then when I was 23, I decided, no, I want to be a podiatrist, which might sound like an odd choice to a lot of people, but at the time I was a big netball player. I think I'd had every lower limb injury under the sun. And a couple of my mates that I was at college with had gone that way and really inspired me to look into it. So I went in at 23 years old, Southampton Uni, and decided that I was going to do this degree. But after it, I was going to set up a private practice and specialise in sports podiatry. So I was absolutely crystal clear at that point about what path I was going to go down.
Brilliant. No, that's it. How did you find like having done now just to mention, I know a lot of this stuff already from the books. Really, it's not just a plug for it, but I'm really enjoying it. It's like it's a really easy to read and an interesting journey because I'm really interested in people's backgrounds. And I love your one in particular because you've had that experience of a number of different things. Like even the fact that you've done psychology, I think is fascinating because that the way people think. And then also then like recruitments, like that is known as that the hardcore of sales. How helpful has having that background been for you doing what you're doing now?
Sure. Well, interestingly, psychology, I think my limited exposure to that at university hasn't really helped that much. It's been since then that I've read books and learned more about psychology and human behavior, that's really helped with being a leader. But recruitment, oh my goodness, that taught me how to run a business. You know, the hard knocks of recruitment, you know, one minute you're on top of the world when you're getting your deals in, and the next day you're crying on the floor because it's all gone terribly wrong. And I think that really helps build resilience when you're in that kind of environment. And you have to adapt as well, because at the time when I was in recruitment, it was a very changeable market. Some of the markets that I was working in were tanking at the time, and you had to then move into a different market very quickly and learn that. So recruitment definitely taught me resilience, but taught me that adaptability, but also about how a business runs. And I've really taken those experiences and the skills that I learned running a team there into building a practice.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, and it's like when I was thinking of what do I want to do as a job and so on. My brother was like, get into sales, understand it, and I'd never thought of myself as a salesperson. But I think it's a relevant one for people in healthcare because what even is a salesperson? Like, who isn't in sales in literally any walk of life?
True.
And it's like with recruitment particularly, they get a bit of a bad rap, really. And at our office, we've got some recruiters next door, great people, really energetic, really motivated. And it's like, what a great way to get into something. Now, I'm not saying I want to do it for ages, but in terms of learning and developing and, like you said, resilience, speaking to people, confidence, like organization, all of these like general skills that you can learn. I think like getting into some sort of say hardcore sales is massively helpful for literally any profession.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you touched on what is sales. It's relationships. It's building relationships with people, building that credibility and that trust. And in recruitment, the best recruiters build trust, and they deliver on what they say they're going to deliver on. And it's the same in healthcare. I mean, I think one of the key skills I learned in recruitment was the interviewing side, because we're interviewing our patients every day, aren't we? You know, but we're interviewing them to find out all the things, you know, that we need to know about their past, their present, their future goals. And then we're synchronizing that to figure out what the most likely problem, you know, what the likely clinical diagnosis is. And then we're planning out a plan which is going to help them reach their, you know, what it is they want to achieve. So there's so many transferable things from working in that environment. Not that I'd necessarily recommend it as a foundation for becoming a healthcare professional, but it certainly did give me a good basis. And of course, you're working to targets, aren't you?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people go into private practice and don't consider that you are running a business and not doing it as a hobby. So you need to understand what business success looks like and how that breaks down into numbers. And recruitment taught me that as well.
Yeah, it feels like, again, the UK is one of the worst. And we chat to a lot of international people, and they're like, yeah, the UK, brilliant in research, really good at certain things, very proper, all this. And it's funny when you're like ripping me, really, to some extent, but it's like there's such an aversion to that. It being told, oh, I don't want to talk to them about, like, I know Shockwave was important to what you did. It's like, oh, I don't feel like we should be charging for that. We don't want to do that. And there's a real aversion to it. And we're jumping ahead in terms of that now. But that I think having gone through that background makes you just put you on the other side of understanding. Yet we need to be able to generate money to help more people or whatever it may be.
Yeah. And in healthcare, it's about ethical selling, isn't it? I personally have this ethos in my clinic that if we're not offering somebody a gold standard solution, then we're not doing our job properly. And if that gold standard solution happens to cost £1,000, then who are we not to give the patient that opportunity to have that gold standard option? You know, it's not our right to take that away from them because we're judging what they can afford or we're trying to dilute our services to meet a budget. And I feel really strongly about that. And I see that far too often in private practice, where people are giving piecemeal approaches or what I call additive approaches to healthcare treatment. We'll try this and see how it goes. I don't agree with that. You know, why aren't we offering them everything that we can to give them the best outcome in order to get them to their goal at the beginning? That's what we should be doing. It doesn't matter how much it costs. It's up to them whether they want to take that on. And for us to work backwards and try and come to a compromise solution if that isn't within their budget, and try and do the best we can for them.
It's almost the opposite way around. It's if you're not doing that, then you're doing them a disservice, because you're doing your due diligence on, does the product work from the evidence and from your experience of working them. So it's that they're trusting you, aren't they, with what's the best way to get better.
Yeah, and if they're paying a decent fee to come and see you in the first place, they expect you to tell them exactly what you think they should be doing. You know, what is the gold standard? They don't want us to give, you know, anything less than that. So I think there is definitely challenges, let's say, with healthcare professionals operating, you know, with that approach. And it might be, I mean, most people go into healthcare, don't they, because they want to do a good job and they're not commercially minded. But you can end up not doing a good job by not presenting those high value treatment options.
Yeah.
Catch 22.
No, it is. It is. And it definitely does resonate with it, because, albeit, you know, we're essentially a sales company. Sometimes it's like, well, how do you invest more in supporting with education or different clinicians to support the people that are going to be using it? So it is catch 22, but we'll come back to that later on. So in terms of you then, so you're doing your podiatry, and then what was your transition into like working clinically?
So I graduated, and as I said, I always knew that I wanted to end up in private practice, but I also understood that I had to get that experience before I would go it alone. So my first job was working at the time with Virgin Healthcare, and I was very lucky. I rolled out of uni into a band 6 job doing MSK, which is unheard of these days. I mean, you just wouldn't be able to do that. And during my degree, I'd also worked in a sort of a running store as well, selling trainers and doing gait analysis. So I'd already sort of built up some basic skills and everything else. So that was my first foray, if you like, into MSK podiatry. And then alongside that, I worked as an associate doing all the general care and routine stuff under the mentorship of a guy local to me that had been doing it for a number of years. And I learned loads from him as well. So that was great. Did that for a couple of years. And then I started thinking, right, I'm going to start doing a bit for myself, started doing a few home visits. And then I got this phone call from an agency, Maxima, they were called. And the guy said to me, we've got an opportunity local to you. We need someone with musculoskeletal podiatry experience. We're really struggling to find someone. The guy that's in role at the moment is in the RAF reserves and he's been called up. And we literally need someone that can start on Monday, not that quickly. And I was like, what is it? And he said, it's working for the military. It's a new service. There's only 13 podiatrists in the UK. You would be one of them. And they're doing service development. And it's a great opportunity. Well, that was like red rag to a bull. I was like, whatever I need to do, I need to do this job. And I knew it was going to be amazing. And it was. So I rocked up the next day, faked it a little bit. Like, oh, yeah, I've got loads of experience. I didn't have that much experience at the time. But they were desperate and I was really keen. And I started the following Monday. And I was there a few years and it was the best experience of my life, sort of working with the military. And I've never seen so many broken people. I mean, you know, you think about an MSK service, well, times that by 10 with the types of people that come in when you're in the military. These people are running with load and are in extreme environments, and the footwear they were wearing at the time as well, wasn't great. And I had this amazing experience where I learned how to do complex orthotics, and I had all this amazing kit that I could work with. And I was working with sports medicine consultants and physios and rehab instructors. And I think that made my career. That experience really gave me the platform to be able to excel in the field of musculoskeletal podiatry. And from that came other opportunities. So because I was working with such great people, they also were doing great things outside of the military. And I got introduced to the manager of Exeter City Football Club. And I started doing consultancy within the professional football field. And that was amazing as well. I also got invited to work in one of the flagship sweatshop stores as well in Southampton. And I met a guy called Hugh Brasher, who is the London Marathon director now, and built a relationship with them and set up a private practice above their running store. And then I met people in London and started doing stuff in Teddington. And I just said yes to everything, Andy. I think when you're at the beginning of your career, the best thing you can do is just say yes and, you know, collaborate and meet new people and put yourself out of your comfort zone. Because for me, it just opened up so many opportunities to do what I always wanted to do, which was work with an elite sport, you know, with amazing athletes, but also help your everyday athletes, your recreational athletes, you know, reach their goals. And I absolutely loved it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, isn't it exciting? Like when you can still see now that you're just like, wow, this is, you know, at the time, this is amazing. And being able to see and take that, and you might have to blag your way in a little bit just to get through the door. But again, who doesn't do that as well? It's like you kind of need to bend it a little bit to just get people confident in you. So then how long were you doing, over what period was that?
That was about sort of 4 years or so, and I was probably working about 60 hours a week. You know, weekends were the football club and going to London to do consultancy in a clinic up there, and I was working flat out. And I think what I mistook at the time was being busy was being successful, and it certainly gave me the recognition and validation that I was always looking for, I think. But when I then got thrown a massive curveball, which was I became pregnant with my daughter, Clara, suddenly realised this amazing business that I had built around myself wasn't a business at all. Because if I couldn't work, I wasn't earning any money. So yes, I ticked the boxes for, you know, building my profile and gaining that recognition in my field, but I hadn't built the business that I always dreamed that I would build. I'd got it wrong.
And then just for what was it that you always had in mind that you wanted to do your own business? Where had that come from?
I think I've never worked in a role where I haven't been in control of how much I can earn. So I started off in recruitment at, you know, 19 years old. And that was, you know, very much a base salary and commission. Even working in the running store when I was at uni, you know, you got commission for your sales. And I've always been aligned to being in control of my earning potential. So the thought of working for a salary in any organisation, I just felt wasn't me. It was really restrictive.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's probably quite unique from the people that we've come across in this area. So you've got that entrepreneurial vibe combined with it. It's a good unique combination, which is why you've gone on to do well with what you're doing. So yes, so you just got pregnant then. So what happened then?
I decided, and it was a really scary thing to do, was that I would give everything up other than the private work I was doing in my local village. So I gave up the football club, gave up the military, gave up going to London. I did all of it until I literally dropped a baby there. And then realised that I couldn't be the mum that I wanted to be if I was travelling all over the place and giving myself so much to these other things that I was doing. So I went back to what the original dream was, and that was, I always wanted to build this MSK Centre of Excellence that was going to be raise public perception and that people would want to work for, because, you know, it was a state-of-the-art clinic. So I thought, right, I'm going to write a business plan. I'm going to do this. So I was, at the time, I was just renting a room and working part time, obviously, around having a baby. But I decided I was going to do this, and went to the bank and got laughed at, essentially. And I can honestly say the business plan that I put together is the clinic that I've got today. My clinic is a state-of-the-art clinic. You know, it is amazing. It's got all the kit and all the idea. You know, they say what's that saying?
All the gear, no idea.
All the gear and no idea. But we've got the idea as well. You know, we know what we're doing. And we're not faking it anymore. But at the time, I went to the bank and I was like, I need like 50K or whatever. And I, you know, I'm going to build this amazing clinic and all this kit. And the bank was just like, I'm not going to give you that. You know, what have you got to contribute? And I was like, well, nothing really. I've just got the skills and everything else, and I know I can do it. No. So I ended up literally clawing together about 1,500 quid of my own money and beg, stealing, borrowing, you know, whatever. And bought secondhand instruments, you know, a chair and bit of uniform, and just cracked on, and just cracked on really. And it just seems crazy to think about that time now when I think about what I now have. And I literally built it from the ground up and learned the hard way. Made a lot of mistakes in the early days. I had to recruit very quickly because I had a baby, so that there was demand, but I couldn't service it all. And in my book, there's a brilliant story about my first recruitment mistakes, which is ironic considering I came from a recruitment background. You know, you'd think I'd be good at that. But I made some desperation mistakes, which a lot of people in healthcare have made in recruitment, I'm sure. And kind of found my way over a few years with getting it wrong, essentially. And then things started to fall into place.
But for that period where you, if you'd have been given that 50 grand at that point, like, how has it helped that you didn't get that money?
Oh my goodness. I would have absolutely spanked that up the wall on things that I now know wouldn't have worked. classic mistake that I see in some, you know, into other healthcare owners is they'll build it in the hope that people will come. But they'll buy a fancy piece of kit because if I've got Shockwave, then everyone's going to come and see me because I'll be the only one in town that's got one. You and I both know that is not what happens. In fact, we were talking about it recently, but actually the best thing you can do is create the demand before you even invest in the kit. Mm-hmm. Because then you've got a waiting list or a queue of people that are actually going to want that service. And too often, I think we build it in the hope that people will come and it just doesn't work. And that's what I'd have done with that 70 grand. I'd have built this amazing facility and probably not allocated anything near as much as I needed to marketing the services that I was going to offer, and probably would have gone bankrupt.
So basically the bank were very wise to not
be very wise. Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. Hindsight. Wonderful thing.
Yeah. So how did the practice develop from there?
So started building the numbers. I was very strong on the MSK side, and I bought my first piece of kit once we had sufficient funds, and that was gait analysis kit. And then in time, you know, I bought the Shockwave machine, which I recognized was something that was really going to differentiate me, because it certainly wasn't a popular treatment when I brought it in. I think I was the first podiatrist in the UK to invest in Shockwave, which is pretty cool, actually. I think everyone's got one now. But I knew that if I was going to be seeing loads of plantar fascia and Achilles cases and tendinopathy, essentially, that Shockwave was going to be a really great way of adding to that holistic service that I wanted to offer. I think podiatrists certainly have got a bit of a reputation of just dishing out orthotics. And I was almost becoming that person that I didn't want to be. You know, the only tool that I had in my box was footwear advice and orthotics, and I wanted to become a rehab specialist. So that's what I did. I thought the way that I'm really going to differentiate myself is to develop my rehabilitation and offer things like Shockwave and exercise and strapping and mobilization techniques and all those adjuncts that can really take a patient through to the end of that journey.
I think it's an interesting one with that equipment again work. That's obviously what we do, and I would never want anyone else to be saying, right, you get some equipment and that is, you're buying some equipment and that's a standalone piece of equipment. Yeah. It's like, how does that fit with your philosophy? How does it help you get them to doing that, you know, the rehab or whatever it is you're doing? And I think that's can happen, like even when we're speaking to clinics, is like, right, well, how does this work from a business perspective? And it's got to fit with the model of what that clinic and that person believes in and how they do it. It's like that's what's key to me, is that the Shockwave is not going to be the be all and end all. Ultrasound doesn't solve all your problems. It's like, well, actually, is this going to help with the way that you're trying to work? And sure, that's really critical, or else it's just an expensive waste of money.
Exactly. So typically the benefits that it brought to my clinic was that I was able to do this holistic treatment plan for people, which meant that I did see them for more appointments, which were a higher value, and they got better, quicker without me having to refer them out. So it was a great thing to do at the time.
Great
business decision.
And then it's like, also you mentioned about the recruitment bit then. So what were the mistakes? So what have you learned from the recruitment?
Okay, key lessons here for anyone that's recruiting. First of all, recruitment is just marketing. Okay, do not jump at the first person that comes along, because that generally indicates that you're desperate, which I was. I just had a baby and I was desperate. Decide whether you're going to do an employed model or an associate model. And there's pros and cons to both of those. You know, an employed model means you're going to get someone that's probably aligned to your vision. You know, that they're part of your team and they want to grow with you. Whereas self-employed people, they're generally working for themselves, and that's okay if you want them to fulfill a certain function, but you're going to probably pay more for that. Okay, so decide which way you're going to go and stick to your guns, because you're going to get people apply for your jobs and they're going to ask you for the earth. They might have unrealistic expectations around salary. They might want to do things that don't fit in with your ethos. they may want hours that don't fit in with your clinic. So you need to stick to your guns and make sure that, you know, you're only going to entertain people that fit with what you need. But in terms of getting the right people, the biggest thing is just behavior and attitudes fit. Making sure that person fits your culture. And I'm talking about culture in the context of behaviors and attitude, not anything else. They have to be aligned to the way that you think. Otherwise, it's never going to work. And it can be a very expensive and disruptive exercise recruiting every 6 months, which is what I did for the first few years. I found myself not being able to keep somebody more than 6 months because I just wasn't recruiting people with the right behaviours and attitudes that I needed in the clinic.
Culture is a hard one, though. Like, how do you interview for a cultural fit?
I think, first of all, you need to make sure that you're vision and your values come out in that job description. So it all starts from the job description, because you want to attract people that think similarly to you and you know, are inspired by what you're trying to do, so that they're on your bus. So it starts from there. But when it comes to interviewing, I'm not really that interested in what they've done. I'm interested in what they believe and how they feel about what they do and what's important to them. So I'm very interested in, you know, what is it about the role that interests you? You know, what is a great day at work for you? You know, what are the things that you don't enjoy about your role? And be honest with me. And I just really want to understand the person. You know, what are their character traits? Are they going to fit with me? That's the biggest reason that people don't work out. I tell you what, you know, you're going to get a lot of people that are just after the dollar. Who's going to pay me the most? I don't need those people. I want people that genuinely want to develop with me as an organization and help the business develop as well. So I want people that aren't all about themselves. I think it's important that we give them what they need as well, but it's a two-way thing. So interestingly, actually, I mean, I know we've not come onto it yet, but in the leadership development stuff that I do and the practice mentoring and coaching that I do in leading practice, one of the topics that we're covering in our next masterclass is actually followership. It's like, so we talk about what great leadership is, but what's great followership? And what I would like to see happen across my clients is them communicating what it means to be, you know, a great follower within an organization. So almost having a charter of behavior that people can subscribe to before they sign on the dotted line.
So that's for your team.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to me more about that then. It's quite interesting.
So we do have a charter of behaviors that our team subscribe to before they join us. And the type of things in that are just, it's almost the unwritten ground rules, isn't it? You know, like what are the expectations around turning up on time, about how you dress, about, you know, your ethos around patient care? That's a big one. So you tend to see people that come from the NHS have an ethos of reactive care, because people come in when they've got a problem, they do some treatment, and then they try and get rid of them as quickly as possible. Yeah, because the service can't support them coming in for maintenance or regular treatment. Whereas our ethos is very much about preventative care. So we see a lot of routine foot problems which need maintenance. So therefore we put them on a maintenance program which can last as long as they live, I suppose. So things like that are included in our behavior charter. You know, this is our ethos, you know, on time is late. Bring the best version of yourself to work. You know, everyone's got problems all the time. And that is a fact. People have issues all the time, Andy. But we want to bring the best version of ourselves to work so that we're 100% for our patients and for our team. So that's what our charter includes. And that charter was created by the team. What are we expecting from each other?
I fully agree with that. Because it's, I think when we're talking about mission, vision, you know, values, all of these things, it's very easy to get caught into that, oh yeah, this is what we should have something written here. But if I don't believe in it, I'm like cringing when it's like, we've got to really, and trying to nail that, feel something that you feel like your elevator pitch or your mission, just you genuinely feel, yeah, that resonates with me. That is critical, isn't it? Because it really does make a massive impact with the people you're getting through and just the way you turn up to things.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and then so when you're working out, like you said, that the team have helped come up with that, how did you pull that session together?
So we do an annual strategy day, and within that we'll do a vision refresh. So, you know, does our vision still apply? You know, are we still trying to achieve these things, or have things changed? So we do that as a team. We also revisit our values as a team. You know, are these still relevant? Do they need to change? Same thing, really. And we review the charter. You know, is this still important to us? Is there anything we want to add? And we do that on an annual basis. So the problem is with vision, values, all those things that underpin a great business, if they're not over communicated and frequently discussed, they get forgotten. They're lost. They're just words on the wall. They don't really form the fabric of the organization unless people are living them.
Yeah, and that's what I think, it's the same as well. If you've got like a number of words, and it's like, right, well, what does being professional mean to you? What does being proactive mean? What does being personable, whatever it is, I think having some narrative around it rather than just words on a website or words on a handbook or whatever.
Yeah. So important, and it's got to be done as a team. Otherwise you get, like you quite rightly said, something called consent and evade. And that's where you've got everyone nodding in the room like this going, yeah, that's a great idea, Andy, oh brilliant, love it. And then they walk out of the room and go, that will never work. Well, that's
what a tool he is. What is it the idea about?
And we've all been in those meetings. In fact, we've probably been those people, haven't we, where we're sat there going, yeah, great boss, yeah, nice. And and then we walk away and go, ridiculous.
Yeah, he thinks I'm doing that. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, no, I think it is. Yeah, it is true, and it's trying to facilitate and do those things. I definitely agree, and it does energize people. And once you've got the right people in the room and doing the things, it's like it's an exciting environment to be in. Yeah. And then, so I don't want to jump too far ahead, but like this, the coaching bit, how did that come about?
So a couple of years ago, I was in the very unfortunate situation that my daughter got sick. So we had COVID as a household. And then my 3-year-old at the time, Martha, just didn't really get better. She started walking a bit funny, got quite swollen around the neck, quite lethargic. And I went back and forth to the doctors, and then eventually got sent to the hospital, to A&E, where she was diagnosed with leukemia. And at that point, my life changed dramatically. So at the time, I had largely reduced my caseload, and my team were pretty much seeing most of the patients, and I was very much in a kind of leadership role within my practice. But when Martha got diagnosed, I had to completely step away and care for her. And I didn't know how long that was going to be for, actually. I had very little communication with my team for a few months. And I was in that horrific situation where I watched my figures start going like that and felt powerless to do anything about it.
That's the company figures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I realized that what had actually happened, even though I wasn't seeing patients anymore and I'd kind of was leading the clinic, I'd created dependency on me as a leader. And without me being present, the team lacked that direction, that focus, that you know, that push that they needed to do what, you know, what we were doing. And that resulted in a decline in the numbers. And I don't want to do my team a disservice here, because they were working hard, but they didn't have that leadership to steer them and provide that focus. So I knew I had to do something quite dramatic. I had to, you know, I couldn't jump back in and save the day, because my little one was having chemotherapy. She was very sick. And I was fortunate enough that I had not long before that met my current partner, Paul, who's the co-founder of Leading Practice. And he was a leadership consultant, he still is. And he said, what's lacking is leadership. We need to develop your people to be able to lead their own functions and lead the practice themselves. And he stepped in and started coaching my two senior people, Alice, who's my clinical director, and Sophie, my ops manager. And he started working with them to take the lead on the clinic. And we did a strategy day in the February, and it worked. So we saw the figures decline for 3 months and then go back up in the following 3 months and then continue to go back up. Meanwhile, I was completely out of the picture caring for my daughter. And it was incredible to watch how that had transformed my clinic. And the following January, we moved into new premises and things continued to grow and thrive with that new ethos in our clinic of leadership. So we decided, as off the back of that, that this wasn't an uncommon issue. You know, there's loads of practice owners out there that, you know, for through no fault of their own, are forced to step back, whether that be to care for a loved one because they're sick themselves, or they simply just want to retire or sell. So we realized that this wasn't something that was commonly taught or mentored, even in the coaching sector. You know, mainly it was kind of practice growth stuff that we were seeing from coaches. So we designed a program where we would do all three things. So we would focus on building leadership in practices and helping leaders step back, help them also grow their practices using all the tools and strategies that I had used in practice in Active Step, but also build resilience into their practices so that if they were hit by something like COVID or a loss of team member or anything, any forced closure, anything really, that they had some resilience in place that would help their practice continue. And that's what we've been doing for the last 18 months. And we've been building a group where we coach people and we deliver immersive masterclasses. And we've got this amazing community of shared knowledge and wisdom that are connected to each other and helping each other.
Yeah, that's great. It's definitely, again, I spend most of my time going and visiting clinics, and you can see ones that are like really got brilliant skills, really good aspects of things. And it's always easy when it's not you that's in the thick of it. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, like reflecting on art of my business and what we need to improve on that. And I'm sure there'd be so many, probably the vast majority of clinics would really benefit from having some external support, even just someone coming and looking at it and saying, you know, that coaching model of you know, trying to get them to come up with their own ideas and solutions for things, like we touched on the equipment before. It's like, actually, you've got the answers most likely. How do you get that out of them?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, most of them do have, you know, the answers themselves. But there's also a lot of the time they don't actually have the experience to draw on because they've done it the way they thought they should do it. And that's not always been right. So I do a lot of mentoring as well from a position of experience, not just coaching. And I feel I can really add a lot of value that way too.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. Because you think of when I see, like, in my time, I've been involved in this area for about 17 or 18 years now. And the shift from where I was spending a lot of time was NHS was 70 to 80% of our business. Whereas now, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years, the private sector, the scope is just, the change is massive. And it's like, what, like you're saying, people have got that NHS background. It doesn't really equip you to run your own clinic.
Not
or your own business, isn't it? You're in your own business.
We're seeing this trend, aren't we? You know, with the NHS constricting its services and that increasing demand for private healthcare, we're seeing accidental leaders emerge because you've got all these small practices that used to operate maybe, you know, with one or two people in rented rooms, being forced to grow their teams and maybe take on premises and create businesses to be able to deal with that demand, which is a great opportunity. But like you said, they're lacking that business knowledge, that experience, those skills to be able to sustain that. And that's really scary, isn't it? So I think we're seeing more of that. more accidental leaders. But I think the demand for coaching is no doubt going to increase over the next few years as a result of that growing demand for private healthcare.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think it's a really exciting time. There's, like you were saying about being ahead of the curve, I think there's a lot of things that are changing, and it's trying to how do you assist the market in that area? Like I was reflecting with one of my colleagues who was interviewing me about how we're starting the company, and it is interesting to reflect on things. And I did not have a clue. Like I'd done exactly what I do now in PhysicWhip, but I was doing it as an employed member of staff, where you've got an accounts team, you've got an expenses account, you've got a salary, you've got a team of people just to talk to. Then all of a sudden you're like, bam, I'm on my own here, and I've got to understand VAT. You've got to understand how you charge for things, how you're marketing. You're literally doing everything. And then even when you add to your team, that's just another headache that you've got to manage. So it's like, actually, it's like, my God, this is the actual business of what you do or were doing. You barely do any of that, whereas previously all you did was meetings, sale, whatever it was in my instance, or clinical practice for you to see in patients. All of a sudden that becomes, that's almost like a luxury.
Yeah, it's time out, isn't it? Mm. Yeah, you're so right though. As a business leader, you're wearing all the hats, and I find one of the first things I do is do an audit of people's roles as a business leader and go, okay, what exactly are you doing and how many hours are you spending on it a week, and looking for areas that they should be delegating. The amount of people that struggle just to let go of stuff, it's that fear, I'm not in control of that bit anymore. But that ultimately is part of the process of growing a business. You're going to have to let go in order to grow.
Definitely. Like that one
as well.
So Paul's background then, who was he, what was he doing before he was doing this with you?
Gosh, right. So Paul was 20 years in the British Army as a colonel. He had, he's sort of done all sorts of things. He's done the elite forces, and then ended up as the head of the Army's training and development capability. So he's had some pretty serious roles. And in the sort of latter years of his career, he did coaching qualifications, and he was coaching sort of ambassadors, world leaders, all sorts of fancy people. And he decided that he wanted to take that experience of leadership from the Army and what he was doing there and bring it to the corporate world. So his background is actually, since leaving the Army, coaching CEOs to build high performing teams, deal with team dynamics, and all the stuff that we do in private practice, but on a global scale. So he's got this amazing different perspective that he brings to leading practice, whereas I'm very much from a private healthcare background. So we've just combined our expertise, really, mine in the practice growth area, him with leadership, and of course the experience that we've gone through together with turning my clinic around, and just brought it to market so that other people can benefit from it.
Yeah, that's great. Do you ever like switch off then?
It's really hard, isn't it?
Two just chatting about it all the time.
Yeah. I wonder whether we could create a podcast where we just film conversations that we have, you know, like the fireside chats. It'd probably be quite entertaining, I reckon.
Yeah. But sometimes that is the interesting thing. So just thought what we could do for the next workshop, whatever it is. Must be quite exciting, but then sometimes it's like, can we just watch this movie and just like not talk about anything for a little while?
Yeah. Funny story, actually. We're designing a training program for our, you know, our group, and we decided we're going to do, we thought, why don't we book a holiday and spend the morning designing the training program and the afternoon sightseeing and then going out and everything, because we never get blocks of time together to do that stuff. So we booked to go to Portugal, to Lisbon for a week, where we're going to have a working holiday.
Brilliant. Great city. Yeah. No, that. Well, I think that is good, isn't it? Getting out of your environment, I think, is critical to just not be in the day-to-day. And it's like, actually, you're away, even though, you know, you're still doing the same thing. Just committing that time is a really important thing to do.
Yeah.
Mm. It's tough. Yeah, no, it's great exciting journey. Though. It's really, yeah, really exciting. So then for you then, so I know that you're really into professional development and read a lot of books, which if you were going to pick, say, well, I don't want to limit you on the number of books, but let's say 3 to 5 books that you think are really have helped you.
So Atomic Habits by James Clear. I love that book, and I often go back and revisit it as well. So that one is a really good one. Oh gosh, you've really got me now. Definitely the Simon Sinek stuff about start with why. I think it's so important that people, when they're building a business, have that clear purpose. You know, they understand what their purpose is, that drives their vision. Because otherwise it's a passionless project, and often won't get people on board with it either. So they'll struggle with recruitment and you know, team building, etc. So I think start with why, Simon Sinek, really, really good. What else is one of my favorites? Oh my goodness. So Good to Great by Jim Collins, one of the first business books that I ever read. And it just speaks so much sense about what makes great businesses. You know, you can be average and you can be run of the mill, but what makes a great business? So that one's a really good one to look into. And then Susan Jeffers, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. Have you read that one?
I've not done that one, actually. I'm aware of it, but I've not done it.
Yeah, it's not a difficult read, but I think it's one of those ones whenever you've got that horrible feeling of should I, shouldn't I, just, you know, what's the worst that could happen? It's probably not that bad, right? So you might as well just do it. And yeah, it talks about just seizing the moment and, you know, feeling that fear, but just going with it. And generally things turn out, even if you get it wrong. So that was quite a nice one. I'm having a little look at my bookshelf here, actually. We talked earlier about general business books, and I think both of us are quite a fan of Dan Priestley. So he's written several books. He's talked about marketing. So he's got Scorecard Marketing, which talks about creating demand for a product before you launch it. Really, really useful. And obviously raising your personal brand within your sector. So if you want to be someone that people want to work with and you want to attract patients to all the amazing stuff you're doing, you need to position yourself as an influencer within your field and as a key person that people want to talk to, want to connect with, want to be around. So he's got this great book, which I know you've got as well, called Key Person of Influence. And he also talks about really taking it to the next level. So, you know, positioning your authority with books, podcasts, etc., which both of us have done, and creating that following, because that, you know, is really critical to, you know, to future growth of your business.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think they're all really good. And it's something you can get. I go to an airport and I get very excited. And it's like, look, I'm not buying any books on this flight. I'm just not doing it. And then I don't always stick to that because it is quite exciting to get a new book. Yeah, you mentioned like Daniel Priestley's stuff and like the podcasts, I think, with him are great because he comes across really well, very easy to listen to. Another one, have you done The E-Myth?
I haven't done that one.
That's a brilliant one. And I think it'd be really helpful for businesses because it's about processes. So it's about setting your business up so that you don't have to work in it. And that really resonates with me because like you, pardon?
I definitely ought to read that one.
Well, no, for your stuff I think it's really good. Again, quite a short-ish book, and it's just very streamlined. Get everything in place so that you don't need to be involved in everything. So it's basically setting you up as a business that you could franchise or whatever else.
Yeah.
So no, that's good. Yeah, no, look, I could genuinely chat with you all day about just books, actually. That would be really interesting. But what would your, I know you touched on some of the advice to people now, but if you were talking to people either in the industry currently or getting into it, what's like something that you would say to them?
I think you've got to start with the end in mind. You know, think about what it is you're trying to build and work backwards and have a plan. Because as much as no plan survives the enemy, having no plan is a recipe for failure. So, making sure that you've at least got a 12-month plan, but ideally got a 3 to 5 year vision so you know what you're working towards.
Good. No, that's good advice.
People experienced and new to it.
No, definitely. Well, I'm doing something similar that you're doing in Portugal. I'm going to the States. It's a work trip, but I'm committed to being, I'm leaving my senior leadership team in charge. And one of them was like, this is a great chance, Andy. I think basically for you to keep out of it and let us just run it. And I'm like, oh, love that. Great. And to kind of like formulate some ideas. So no, I think it is really important to always be thinking what you want to do. And it is exciting. It's the stress and anxiety, but it is really exciting if you've got the ideas and you're still like really passionate about what you're doing, which I know you are. And they're brilliant. Really think what you're doing is great and really helping the industry. So well done with that. And I look forward to watching your progress.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's been great talking to you.
Brilliant. Thanks, Emily. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too.